Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us California poet Kevin Clark. He's the author of two full-length collections of poetry, Self-Portrait with Expletives, which won the Lena Miles Weaver Todd Prize of the Pilates Press and In the Evening of No Warning. His creative writing textbook, The Mind's Eye, A Guide to Writing Poetry, features progressive graduation of writing exercises designed to give students fluency in the major aspects of contemporary poetry writing. He has been an ArtSmith Fellow and a Breadlow Fellow and teaches both at the Rainier Writers Workshop in Tacoma, Washington, and at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, California. Other prizes include the Angoff Award from the Literary Review and two University Teaching Awards. He is a regular critic for the Georgia Review, and his essays about poetry appear widely. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Hi, thanks so much, Sheila.
I'm very much looking forward to hearing you read some of your poems and to discussing your poetry career. And I'm very intrigued by the number of wonderful awards you've won, and I know you've had a long career in poetry, so I was wondering if you might tell us a little bit about how awards in the life of a poet work, what it was like to win them, why the fellowships like the ones you received to ArtSmith and Breadloaf were helpful to you, and what you might tell other poets about competing for awards.
It's funny, when it comes to things like magazine contests or residencies, I rarely ever compete. When it comes to magazines, I just send my poems and hope an editor enjoys it enough to accept it. But in the terms of Breadloaf, I was going to go to Breadloaf no matter what. I wanted to go. It was 1990, almost 30 years ago. And I did apply for financial help, and they gave me a good-sized scholarship. I'd been publishing here and there. I had a big teaching load at Cal Poly. I was the father of a young child. There was a lot of things going on in my life. So time was kind of at a minimum. And I really wanted to go to Breadloaf, which is 12, 13 days or something, and it's a beautiful place to go. So the scholarship allowed me to focus. It was a break from my routine. It gave me great advice. I made terrific friends there. The ArtSmith, that fellowship for a week to write at the Kangaroo House on Orcas Island, that was just a joy because, as far as I know, the writer doesn't apply. I just kind of heard, I got an email, I think, saying, if we were to give you this, would you be interested in taking it? I'm like, yeah, I think so. Jill Johnson, who's a terrific poet on the ArtSmith board, and Tina Schumann, who's on that board, they were involved. Jill and her husband Charles own the Kangaroo House, and they gave me this week of writing at their beautiful bed and breakfast. My wife Amy joined me, and she read and read, and I wrote and read and kind of rekindled. But I didn't compete for that. I did apply for Breadloaf. The things I compete for are books and chapbooks, and that's pretty much it. Now, what does it do for a poet? It gives you a boost. It's very hard to imagine a poet who hasn't been overrun with rejections. You submit manuscripts and they get rejected. To have a poem taken is a little joy. To get one of these fellowships is a big joy. To win a poetry book contest like the one at Pleiades, that was a major boost for me. And I think what it helps, and we could talk about this later, I suppose, but what it helps to do is it gives the writer more confidence to take yet more risks, to write further and further into the forest where she or he hasn't been.
Wow. So, I think what we need is more awards and more fellowships and more residencies and more of all that to help more poets be able to get that boost. So if anyone's...
I'm along for that ride.
Yeah. I think it's a good that people are taking an interest like the people at Kangaroo House. Why do you take contests out of the mix?
I think the odds of winning a contest are not great, and frankly, since it's not great, I'm reluctant to spend a lot of money on those kind of contests because those contests usually ask for $20 or $30 or something to enter. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the kind of contest where a magazine or some venue says, we'll pay $500 and print your poem in our journal or some kind of venue, but you have to send no more than two poems or three poems, and you have to send us $25. I'm just disinclined to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think that applies to me too, because I think if a journal wants your work, you're going to get paid in copies maybe, but that seems like a safer bet and more probable that your work would be selected
by
the
editor.
Yeah,
more probable. This is not comparatively a cutthroat world we're in the world of poetry, but it's highly competitive in the sense that there are so many very fine poets out there who are sending their work out. When I was in school back in the 70s, I was told that there may have been somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 professional poets, which they defined as poets who consistently sent work out and had it published. And I bet it's 2, 3, 4 times that number now.
Yeah.
And I love many of the poets who are writing today. I read a lot, and I know how good they are, and it's not easy to get your work placed in kind of journals that get a lot of readers.
Right. On the other hand, because of the advent of online journals, for people entering now or even very experienced poets, there are some more places to publish, which is exciting. So,
Absolutely. I publish a couple of times in a place called Apercus, A-P-E-R-C-U-S, the French. It's in way, way, way down in Southern California is where the editors are. And it's a beautiful journal. And that kind of venue is very helpful. And I bet, because I've published in some pretty good places, I'm willing to bet that at least as many, if not more people, read my stuff on Apercus than do in some of the other journals
right.
I've been in, which have bigger names.
Right, because the print numbers are not that high for small presses. So
that's right.
I want to thank you for that, and I hope that any listener listening who wants a boost can find a writing fellowship or residency, or take one, make their own. It doesn't have to be far away from home for that to work. But away from home works better than at home, like you said, to get away from all your stuff. So would you like to read to us from your book, Self-Portrait, and tell us a little bit about the poems?
Sure. Self-Portrait came out, I think, 2012. I have two manuscripts that I'm working on right now. One is virtually finished, and the other is close, so I have worked since, and I'll read something new later, but I try to write not simply about my life, but I seem to have subjects that keep recurring. People pointed this out to me. I didn't even realize it, but I seem to write about mortality and occasionally about politics. When I write about mortality, it's often associated with love. It's usually either romantic love or familial love. So I'm going to read a poem that is called Flashback at Castelfranco. It's set in Florida and Italy, and it's about how the natural world seems to hold answers to eternal questions. But sometimes you go along, you find the natural world can be pretty inscrutable at times, even though it can be so beautiful. I was in Italy years ago, and I found myself thinking about the two different stages of my life at that time. I had children. My daughter, I think, I don't know, she was young, and my son was early teenager, and I felt so different. I felt like two different people. The person who had been in his 20s and even early 30s without children, and now this person who was, I think, so much richer and more resonant for having children, but also so much more paranoid about being a father, so much more caring about these little creatures that I was taking care of. I was thinking, wow, what a difference in my life. And so in this poem, I remember a particularly existential kind of mortal moment that took place in the 60s and how it contrasts with this moment I experienced in Italy with my daughter. So it's called Flashback at Castelfranco. Castelfranco is a town south of Florence. Dawn in Micanopy, Florida. and the old Impala floats the canopy roads, the last hours of acid stripping the protective film from the world. So every tree and fence blazes with end of bandwidth jitters. My breath, a shallow tinnitus audible in the orbit of my limbs. I cut the radio and slow to an idle beneath the live oaks, Spanish moss dripping to the roadside floor. My only god, the present moment. Then I turn off the car lights to drift in new moon silence. For a few seconds, a great maw encloses. In beauty and terror, I flash the lights back on to stay true to the road beneath the canopy, and a white fence glows in a burst until I kill the beams again, one fascination and another, the world's first question strobing on and off. 30 years later, on this moonless Scotch broom hill above three sleeping late Renaissance steeples, all the little windows flicker on below like fireflies in the olive trees. As the dark mountain hulks beneath the last bright shine of sky across the valley, the molecules of another air seem to flood this one. My 10-year-old stands with her binoculars and stares into the same alluring Tuscan spill, a silent vista so redolent one can see how prayer erupts. Aglow, entranced by sunset, she asks, how far to the mountains there on the other side? And as I answer in the explanatory lingua she loves, a host of paternal lies rise, then resign in my chest. For I know what she'll come to know some long road course night. We live in two places at once. There is darkness, and there is the lit-up world, and behind both, an immeasurable quiet.
Thank you, Kevin. I love the experience of how the moment with your daughter and the lights of the houses in Tuscany must have reminded you of that night in Florida, and how the poem starts in Florida, and then we find out how these things are connected in the now of the poem, and the turning off the lights and turning them back on, the floating Impala. My father had an Impala, I remember. The feeling of those cars. And just bring that journey to that moment when you know as a father that your daughter is going to face these things, but this is not what we tell them then. This is not what they can know then. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking today with California poet Kevin Clark about his poetry, career as a poet, and how he teaches new poets to write toward surprise. Visit kevinclarkpoetry.com to learn more about him.
I'd like to take a little break from poems right now and ask you about your work as a critic. I think that that's kind of a dicey thing in our world right now. I know some critics choose not to write about books they don't like and only write about books they do like. And especially in the world of poetry, how does that work for you, writing critical pieces for the Georgia Review and other places?
I've written for a number of places, but I'm a regular critic for the Georgia Review. I am now down to writing one long essay review per year. And the thing about the Georgia Review is they pay. It takes me 6 weeks to write these, and they don't pay more than, I don't know, a dime an hour or something. But I like the idea that our work, whether it's poetry or criticism, has some kind of value in the real world as well. I am writing a review right now. Each review I write for Georgia, I don't think I've written one that's in the last 10 years that's fewer than 7,000 words. Most are 9,000 words. And in most, I review 3, 4, or 5 books, but I write a pretty extensive kind of lens into poetry in general, and then specifically into the books I'm reviewing. So I started out that way. It's whatever I happen to be thinking about, which we can go into at some time. For instance, right now, I'm focusing on Theodore Adorno's famous saying, to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric. It's a really interesting subject, and he's so smart, and the term barbaric means something for him that I didn't understand until I started looking into it. But that just gives you some idea. I guess you're asking, what does the word critic mean for me?
Yeah.
It means a number of things. It certainly means responsibility. I want to engage the poet's work on the poet's terms. I think I have to make clear my own aesthetic while I'm doing that. And I want to try to connect the work with the tradition of poetry. I want to try to connect the work to the larger world. So I see being a critic as having pretty broad charge. Does that help at all?
Oh, it helps me a lot because I feel like you're in the service of poetry when you're putting groups of four or five books together and meeting the poet on their own terms and explaining those terms to the reader of your reviews. So it helps a lot. It's a very fundamental engagement with poetry and poets and sharing that. And I'm sure, just as I didn't know the poet you're speaking about now or the meaning of the word barbaric in his terms, that it would be a very educational experience to read that particular review, and I'm sure all the reviews that you're writing. And I praise the Georgia Review for allowing such long work in their magazine.
Well, that length that they give me is very helpful.
Yes.
Just to be clear, Theodore Adorno, most people in the U.S. don't know him. He was European. He wrote in German. And he was, as far as I know, I don't think he wrote poetry. He was basically a critic, but he was kind of a famous cultural critic.
Uh-huh.
He was, when he wrote that, to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric, that quote, it's been misinterpreted often. So it just struck me as a really interesting thing to write about.
Right. And poets will understand that and still write poetry. And I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So when
Which he wanted, by the way. He wanted people writing poetry.
Right.
He just wanted us to understand what it meant to be living in a barbaric world.
Yes. Thank you. I don't want to neglect hearing one of your newer poems before we have to end our conversation.
I think I'll read a somewhat political poem. It's actually an environmental poem.
Okay.
And I'm going to dedicate this to Peggy Shoemaker, who is a terrific poet and, among other things, writes brilliantly about the natural world. And she and her husband, Joe Isabelli, have a home in Hawaii. And she offered that home to my wife and me and to another couple. And so we went to the Big Island. God, it was beautiful. We ended up going to a National Historical Park there, and my Hawaiian is so bad that my native Hawaiian, I would just butcher this, so I'm not going to say the name of it, but it contains the City of Refuge. The old ancient City of Refuge, the place where people who were caught and were guilty of breaking the important political or religious laws in ancient times, they could avoid the death penalty by getting to the City of Refuge. It's a kind of sanctuary. And I'm thinking when I'm there about what I have to say is the undeniable, imminent eco-disaster awaiting the world. One of the friends we were with asked, is it so bad, do we have to give up? And the poem is about that fear. Two other things. There's a word called ali'i, which are the refugees, the people who have broken the law and get to the city to save themselves. And the other is the word guilt. And most people hear guilt as G-U-I-L-T, but I'm using it as guilt, G-I-L-T, which is a kind of burnished gold color. Sunset on the Big Island, Peggy Shoemaker. Sky acts as if we have every right to be happy. At the ancient City of Refuge, we stare from the perch of the ali'i down upon the lilting wavelets, beneath which the yellow fish intend only this present moment and the next. What is that rounded lightness, I ask, out in the middle of the dimming lagoon? The oval shape submerged in the lava-dark bottom, the blonde circle drifting in slow motion, forward, then back slightly against the tide. Last night, one of us suggested there's little time left. Maybe we'd no choice but to surrender to the boiling of the ice, our small wills inadequate against the binary greed of engines. And then our friend asked, but what of our grown children, their little ones soon enough forced to forage upon rocks? We study the glinting center of the lagoon as if fascination were reprieve. People of a dozen languages gather along the ridge, gaping with us, when that circular light, a large sea turtle, snouts up for air, as if to witness the lives above her. And so, in guilt unison, we all point and gasp inside the shrinking breath of sky.
A very sobering poem. And among all that beauty is this fear and knowledge that our environment's changing so fast. So you were lucky to see that. And
oh, it was so beautiful. And at the same time, I was so conscious
right,
of it.
Right.
You and I have talked about the term duende. If I had one aesthetic point of reference about art, it would be that the work have some kind of duende. Duende was Lorca's term for a kind of dreamlike intuition about our innate state of mortality. And that if you, an adult, knows this and serious work, whether humorous or not, needs to be informed by duende. So I suppose that's the thing I hold at the center of my ideas about what makes good work, good art.
So let's segue with that into your book about writing poetry and the graduated exercises so that new poets can refine their work, even, you know, against this backdrop of what we're examining as poets, which is our mortality. How does that work? How do you help an inexperienced poet move along towards the kind of poetry that experienced poets like yourself are capable of writing? Big question.
I think it's really important that a creative writing workshop be a place where people are allowed to take risks and fail. And the failures should never be crushing. They should be opportunities to see yet again more opportunities to work, to go further. Of course, this depends on who I'm working with as a teacher. So at Cal Poly, I would have, sometimes I had 18 and 19-year-olds who were taking a poetry writing class for the first time and didn't know much about poetry. And so I wrote a book, this textbook called The Mind's Eye, for basically for college students, 18 to 22, though of course it could apply to folks much, much older. It's really not your age so much that it would help, but it's written for people who are coming into the world of poetry. In that workshop, I want them to feel safe and to start with the basics and to have a good time playing with words. I want them to be able to surprise themselves with their own words. I don't worry right away about anything like duende or stuff like that in the beginning. I just want them to start to get the feel for language that is fresh. Because let's face it, all the language around us is not so fresh. One common term, one cliche after another bombards us. So I try to encourage them to write with strangeness, with a kind of excitement based on combinations of words they haven't ever written or haven't even thought of before. And then later, we start to talk about subjects that will, without me using language like duende, will bring them closer and closer to their own most important concerns.
Thank you. And it seems to me that the process that you're doing with your students and in the book is very close to the process a poet has to do themselves when they're writing, to feel safe, to explore what seems weird and uncontrollable, things that are surprises in their writing, to be able to feel that there's opportunity, like you said, rather than condemning the words or trying to push them around prematurely. Do you agree that it kind of mimics the process that a poet goes through?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, I was talking to a really, really good Northwestern poet, Stan Rubin, who you know.
Yes, because he lives here in Port Townsend.
Yes, in Port Townsend. And I was saying, you know, Stan, I think we were talking about, here we are, you know, we're past 60. How do we write something that is something that we haven't done before? And I really think a writer improves by repeatedly going into the imagination over and over and over. And you start, when you just start poetry writing, you start doing that. You go into your imagination, and the repetition of going in kind of creates tracks or runnels that you can follow once you go back again. And we follow them over and over, and we get better. But we follow those tracks back in till we get to the end of where we were. And then we have to push further, as I said earlier, into the forest. And we go further, and that's the great risk. That's the point at which we're going to do something. It may fail, but we're going to do something that perhaps we haven't done before. You know, I hope that I and the poet who reads the book can go further into imagination, go further into form, whatever you want to call it, because the further you go in there, the closer you get to whatever is authentic for you.
Absolutely. I do. And I think that you mentioned earlier that things have been pointed out to you about your poetry that you didn't realize till other people said so. And I think as a poet, you feel like if you've accomplished what you're talking about, going further into the forest and doing something you've never done before, you can have a feeling that the poem has arrived and accept it as a finished poem and still not know all of the work that it's doing. So,
oh boy, isn't that
There's this wonderful magic connection, I think, between the poet, the poem, and the ultimate reader of the poem that just is a loop that's so informative and gratifying if you're involved in the work of poetry.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeats said the good poem by the end clicks into place, and boy, you don't know all the implications of that click, but you're very happy about it.
Right, and it's a body experience and one we need to honor. I so much want to thank you for today. Our time is almost over, and I wish we could go on longer and longer, so perhaps again another day. And I want the listeners to remember, or if I haven't said it, that your website is Kevin Clark Poetry, KevinClarkPoetry. Sound like I'm in a spelling bee, .com. And there you can find information about other books that Kevin has written and more about him. Again, thank you so much for this time together.
Thank you, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.